Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with my co-host Tim Henney. Today in the program, we'll speak with three-time former Park City Mayor Brad Ulch. As a three-term mayor and one who worked on bringing the Olympics to Salt Lake through two Olympic bids, he's made a lot of observations around the globe about what works in towns like ours. We haven't heard from him in a while, maybe years, so we look forward to a conversation with him.
Good morning, Lynn. I'm Tim Henney. Our second guest is Greg McEwen. He's the author of The Book of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. As we head towards summer, we thought this might be a great interview to rebroadcast, as summer days have us thinking about the simpler life. At least it does us.
That's right. All I need is that bathing suit. That's all. This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these words.
Valley Bank. We offer a full spectrum of loans for lots, construction, HELOCs, commercial, and personal needs. Our loan decisions are made locally. Heber Valley Bank is a proud supporter of KPCW. We are located in Heber City and Midway and at Grand Valley Bank in Park City. HeberValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Executive Chef Chris Sheehan from Park Meadows Country Club here, supporting KPCW. We offer regionally inspired cuisine such as pine nut crusted filet of sole for dining inside or outside. Our dining venues are also ready for any occasion, and golf, social, and dining memberships are also available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with Tim Henney. Former Park City Mayor Brad Ulch spent three terms in office. It was the 12 years right up until the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake. Actually, what was it, about 3 weeks before that, when he handed the reins to Dana Williams. Ulch was also a city council person and longtime planning commissioner, and has spent many decades seeing this town shape and grow. He also worked on several Olympic bids, the last one, the successful one. In doing so, he traveled the world looking at many different towns like ours. Looking from the perspective of a mayor and also looking at many comparisons between the various resort towns, he learned a lot. He's joining us today to talk about some of these observations and how his preferences and perhaps predictions have played out, and also get his thoughts on Park City's future. Former Park City Mayor Brad Ulch, welcome to The Mountain Life.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're happy you could join us today. We wanted to talk to you because both as mayor and when you were working on Olympic bids way back when in the mid-90s, you had the opportunity to do a lot of traveling and traveling to former Olympic sites, ski resorts around the world, really. And you saw things both through the lens of a mayor, but also a curious person and someone looking to bring the Olympics to Salt Lake, which indeed happened. Talk to us, if you would, about what you have seen around the world in terms of creative solutions to things like transportation and layout of towns that that you found notable.
This was all mid-90s. I was a keynote speaker at a World Ski Resort Symposium in Courchevel and got a chance to talk to a lot of lift purveyors, and we actually had them come and take a look at Park City. And the reality was it was a little too expensive and at the time to do. And then, of course, we ended up talking about that pasture land, which is now the post office and the police station. Then we got a lot of pressure from the post office because they had a little annex over on, across from the cemetery on Kearns Boulevard, and they needed to expand, and they wanted to build a big post office, and they were threatening either find us a place in town or they would actually move the post office out of town. So we sort of folded on that, you know, to the post office, and so the thought of building a transportation hub on that particular site with a chairlift connection to PCMR and maybe some sort of rail transportation up to Main Street and over to Deer Valley, you know, kind of got pushed aside at that point. And then, of course, we get awarded the Olympics, and of course our focus changed, you know, dramatically after that anyway.
So 20 years ago, do you think that all the different elements and the the challenges were similar? Was congestion a driver for this, or was it more, here's a cool thing we could do to really differentiate ourselves as a community from other North American ski resorts? Or was it the same combination that we kind of look at today?
No, I mean, I think, yes, we had congestion, but we don't have the congestion. We didn't have the congestion then that we have now.
Right.
They had just completed or were still completing the expansion of 224 from a small country two-lane road with no traffic lights and a couple of billboards out of Kimball Junction to what we see today. So, you know, obviously the congestion changed a lot. I was very fortunate. I spent a lot of time overseas in my position as lobbying for the Olympic Bid Committee. Spent a lot of time in Courchevel, Sister City, all the other resorts. And you know, one of the things that we did in the United States is we gave up passenger rail service after the war. And for the Europeans who were poor, this was a very inexpensive way for them to have transportation. Cars were very expensive. Very few people could get around after the war. And so the rail option to all these little communities, you know, was their mode of transportation. And so why not take another look at what they're doing there as it relates to what we're doing here? You know, the real dramatic and hard answer to really try to solve the problem here in our community, I think, is, you know, you look at what we've done or what we did during the Olympics. If you were a resident, you got a pass. You knew when it was going to be congested. You worked around that. And maybe we do something like that, where if you're a resident, you get a pass. If you don't live here in town, you know, you have some obstacles. Maybe we create a 10 to 20-year plan for some sort of surface transportation, you know, outside of just doing the buses. We create some exciting park and ride situations, and maybe it's rail, maybe it's, you know, rail on tires, you know, some sort of bus system. You know, you come into town to ski, you can buy your lift tickets at the transportation center. You take a bus to Deer Valley, you take a bus to the canyons, take a bus to PCMR.
Well, and then we've got the gondola that's going to come down from Silver Lake to the Transit Center, most likely on Main Street, and that's something that could actually happen within the next couple of years. I mean, that's something that's, you know, I hear through the drawing board stage, and, you know, the alignment and the access issues are being negotiated, and I think at the final stages of that also. And so we could see a proposal before the city for that actual gondola coming down as a mode of transportation from Silver Lake to the Transit Center, which is really exciting. It's what you were talking about from that pasture, which is now the police station and the post office.
Right. No,
20 years ago.
Oh, no question. I think that's it's a great thing to put that gondola down onto Main Street. Anybody who's been to Telluride, you know, they have a similar situation from the upper mountain down into the village of Telluride. And I think it runs till midnight, 1 o'clock in the mornings, and it's free. And, you know, that's a great thing.
And it draws people.
It draws people. And, you know, you can stay up on the mountain, come down to dinner, entertain yourself, take the gondola back at night. And it's, you know, it's very spectacular at night riding in. And it's,
people get the feel of a novelty experience.
Absolutely. And that's what we really need to create here, is we need to, you know, create something that people are going to buy into. They're going to be excited about it. And, of course, we should never forget that we have to look out for our guests, because that's the
bread and butter.
That's the engine of this community.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to live here and to be a resident, but you know, we're all very dependent on the people that come here.
So you go places as a guest, and when you go to these towns in Europe or in your travels, what is it that that adds to your experience from the transportation and congestion? You know, congestion is an issue. Small towns in Europe, they're dealing with it also. What do they do that adds to your experience as a visitor to their towns? Is it the train? Is it the gondola? How do they get you around?
You know, it's interesting. That's a really great question. It's a combination of all of those things. And, you know, Courchevel in the Trois Vallées, you know, you've got 100 and 200 lifts, whatever. And there's a really every imaginable lift that has ever been produced is somewhere in that ski, I'll call it a ski circus, although there's the ski circus in a place in Austria. And it's just fabulous. You know, you pull up and there's a double quad chairlift. And then there's a gondola in Val Thorens way, way up high that must be the size of the largest Greyhound bus that you've ever seen. They pack 150 people, maybe even more, into this bus. And it's just one fascinating transportation system after another. And then, of course, as you travel in Europe or even in Asia – and you look at the new rail systems and the light rail systems and the narrow gauge of the track and how they kind of meander through the towns. That's sort of what I kind of envision, something like that potentially in the next 10 to 20 years. And very expensive, absolutely. And hopefully in 10 or 20 years or before, you know, the federal government will recover a little bit and – you know, we'll have some legislators that are very receptive to what Park City is doing, and we can get a lot of federal dollars because we used to do that when I was in office, and we were very fortunate to have Senator Bob Bennett, who was on when he left office, he was the senior Republican on the Appropriations Committee. They control all the money. And Bob Bennett brought so many dollars to Utah, it was really unfortunate that he got knocked out by the Tea Party because he was excellent for us. And so hopefully, you know, over a period of time, we'll be able to find someone else who can push some federal dollars our way to solve some of our transportation needs. Because statewide, local-wise, we really can't afford it. All we can really do is kind of plan for it, take some small bites out of it over a period of time. But if you have a plan, at least you're moving in a direction that it's hopefully someday, somehow, you know, the plan will get completed right. And will work and will make Park City even better.
Well, and then there's the whole Mountain Accord initiative that's happening, which is kind of coming together at a crucial time. There's the congestion issues, which are driving a lot of people to reconsider our options for transportation. It seems like there are elements that didn't exist 20 years ago that are kind of coming all together right now. I'd say over the next 5 years is going to be very crucial for some of these key issues, like how we move people around this town.
And so what is your observation now as you hear these things taking shape? Do you just think of yourself as being, you know, a man before his time?
No, that's actually, for me, that's the first time I've ever heard that before. But listen, it's a great thing because anytime you can get a whole large group of people that have common interests actually sitting down and talking about something that ultimately is important now, going to be more important in the future, I mean, that's a really big thing. There certainly was a period of time when I was involved in politics in the 80s and the 90s when, in fact, you know, the standard reply from people in the state was, we don't want to be like Park City. And so that for a long, long time, that was a, you know, huge uphill battle. I ultimately got involved with the Utah League of Cities and Towns, was president of the League of Cities and Towns, their city manager, our city attorney, and a lot of people involved with city government all of a sudden – we're out consulting with other people, other communities in Utah, talking about transportation and planning and things like that, because up until that period of time, a lot of those places had never had any issues where they had to address them that were affecting Park City. And then all of a sudden they found themselves, whoa, people are moving into my community. There's a shopping center going in. What am I going to do? The signage, the transportation issues, the traffic issues. And, you know, we were always seemed to be ahead of the curve. And so anyway, getting back to your question, it's just wonderful to be able to be in a position now where so many people that didn't talk 20, 25 years ago are actually at the table trying to work through solutions.
Brad, that being ahead of the curve, it's really interesting from my perspective because I think this community takes a lot of things that you've just pointed out for granted, that we have this regional collaboration and more of a regional perspective and an attempt to tie in all these different entities, whether it's Wasatch County or Summit County or down into Salt Lake. And the Mountain Accord is a perfect example of that. I mean, here are all these entities coming together that look at these regional challenges of how to protect this beautiful resource, the Wasatch Front, the Wasatch Back. And it seems to me that they have modeled the entire Mountain Accord off of what has come to be in Park City already. They've looked at Park City and said, these guys have it figured out. They know how to run a town, keep the authentic nature of the community and have a vibrant business community at the same time? And how are we going to expand that model? And how has Park City gotten from 20 years ago to where they are today? And they've built the Mountain Accord on Park City's model.
No, obviously I'm a little flattered, and that's great. But again, I think in order to achieve what everybody needs to achieve, everybody needs to work together. And especially, and I touched on it earlier, getting federal funds. And obviously it's a lot easier if there's a whole group of communities going to Washington with one voice saying, you know, we need all this money over a period of time to build some of these transportation solutions versus just Park City going and saying, you know, we want to do X, Y, and Z. And they say, well, that's great, but, you know, come back next year. We were successful, I think, because of the Olympics in getting federal funds. And we were on the Olympic list to get federal funds, and which allowed us to build the transportation center and some other infrastructure here in town. You know, you can't depend on Utah getting the Olympics again. Hopefully it will happen, because I think it's a wonderful thing. So, you know, again, with the Mountain Accord, everybody getting together, having an opportunity to maybe with one voice go to Washington, a lot of those things maybe can be accomplished.
Brad, when you were talking about some of the transportation alternatives and the really interesting things that you see when you go to, for example, Les Trois Vallées, it struck me that here it seems like we introduce a concept of getting out of our cars as restricting us, whereas when you come into a beautiful valley in the French Alps, what's presented to you is not a feeling of restriction, but all kinds of options, which it sounds really fun and lovely and all of those good things that come along with a visit to the Alps. Is that kind of how it strikes you? Or do you feel like, oh, this is just what they do here? They don't have a car culture, and so I'll deal with the inconvenience.
No, I mean, if you look at a different example in Europe, outside of Interlaken is a little place called Lauterbrunnen, and there's a big parking facility there. And you get on the train, and you can go back to Interlaken, and you can go up to Muir, and you can go to Wengen, where they run the big Lauberhorn downhill. You go up to the top of I can't think of the name right now, but it takes you up to the top of the Eiger. And then if you continue on the rail, it takes you over to Grindelwald, where Adolf is from. And again, it's a train culture, and they've set it up so you have your car, you park it long term, you get on the other transportation to these mountain villages.
If we were going to model that right here in Park City, what would it look like? And forget about the funding and where the money comes from, but if you were going to recreate what you just described, where does that go and where does that infrastructure happen?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's very, very important that, you know, this discussion not only happened in Park City, but it also has to happen in Summit County and maybe to a lesser extent in Wasatch County. I think we would be foolish not to include them in some sort of conversation of major transportation. Look, out by the landfill off
Richardson
of
Flat.
Richardson Flat, thank you. They have a parking lot there. That could be a really good place to run people into this community at some way. Maybe you acquire, you know, some more right-of-way to run some sort of system. Maybe you expand the rail trail right-of-way to allow something to happen, to get some sort of transportation element into town. You know, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be painful. It's going to take a long time, but I think these are some of the things that we as a community need to get a little out in front of and say, this is the direction we're going to go. Now, keep in mind also that, and I don't really know how this is going to affect Park City, at some point the parking lots at Deer Valley are going to be developed. Parking for the ski area will be underground, and I would be surprised if it was not paid parking. I mean, I suspect it will be. You're going to have the development PCMR on those parking spots at some point. Again, underground parking, you're going to have to pay for it. And you have to look at that. Are people going to pay? What are people going to pay? Or do people really want to do that? And so you give them you force them into another alternative and over a long period of time. And that, I think that's really what we need to do. And again, we need to work with both Summit and Wasatch counties to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting the amount of regional collaboration that is happening now that maybe hasn't happened before, and the need for it is becoming obvious. Wanted to ask you, is it in Courchevel where at a certain time of the night the bars come up out of the roads and block you off? You need a code to get in if you're a resident. Is this something that you've seen? I like to hear these stories of different things that are seen around.
I mean, you know, that those are very prevalent in all sorts of places in Europe, you know, where, you know, the balusters come out of the ground, where you have a pedestrian mall. I mean, a perfect example is you'd put some of these at the bottom and the top of Main Street, if we ever got to that. And in, you know, the mornings, they would come down, the trucks could come in, and the Coke trucks, beer trucks that, you know, service the bars, and they know they have a certain period of time, and then they have to get off the street. And then they go up, you know, 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and maybe Main Street, you know, if we get to that point, you know, becomes pedestrian for a certain period of time. So those are, you know, that's not a new thing that's been happening in Europe a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. So as you see what's happening and taking shape now, do you feel optimistic about what's happening here in our little town as you apply what you've learned and all of your experience around the globe?
So I'm very fortunate. I've been able in my lifetime to travel a lot of places. And I have to say, driving into Park City after being away for a couple of weeks or a month or whatever period of time, it's always great to come back to Park City. Park City is still home. Park City is still a wonderful, wonderful place. I couldn't think of any place I would, you know, rather live. And it's, of course, everybody moves to Park City, and I'm a perfect example in 1976. And you move here and you think, Park City is perfect.
Yeah.
You know, the last settler syndrome, you know, don't change anything, lock the door, don't let anybody else in. And everybody that's moved here since that period of time has probably felt the same way, which is a good thing because it's still a wonderful, a wonderfully great community with great diversification. And truly, Park City gets better all the time.
Hmm. What level of involvement, what are you doing now around town? And I guess what I mean is, you know, you're doing whatever you do privately, but don't tell us about that. But, you know, in terms of public service or... I mean, and you were very involved in getting the Park City Foundation going.
Right. Yeah, I started the Community Foundation, and I have no involvement with that at this point, and it's doing extremely well. And kudos to the people that have, you know, run that, Tricia and Katie and Miles and John Cumming, who really, you know, stayed with it, and you know, it couldn't have been as successful as it is without their help and support. Beyond that, I'm on the Hospital Foundation Board. I'm on the Sheriff's Citizens Advisory Board, which meets a couple times a year. And I have a new granddaughter, and that takes up a lot of time. Not really, but it's very exciting in my life.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on the new granddaughter. And how about Creative Transportation Czar?
Yeah, sure. That works for me.
Brad, what about the Olympics? You mentioned that earlier. Any involvement there, or what do you see happening or the potential for Utah to get the Olympics again?
Well, obviously, we have the potential to do another Winter Olympic Games probably quite easily. Obviously, and I've lost track of the dates, but the U.S. Olympic Committee is looking for a summer city. And so maybe that's 2024. I'm not really sure. I've sort of lost track of it. So let's assume at some point, whether it's this bid process or one afterwards, you know, a U.S. city would get the summer games. I suspect it would probably be at least 4 years, 6 years after that when they would come back and maybe award a Winter Olympics to the United States again. And there are very few places that you can really hold the Winter Games in the United States, and we obviously are one of the great places to do it, and it would be very easy. And again, I think with some of the decisions that the International Olympic Committee has made with Rio, which I think is really challenged, Sochi, which, you know, $50 billion they threw so much money at. I suspect that the next time around, the next voting for the IOC, they potentially could go with a safe choice.
And with your knowledge of how these things work, are you seeing a certain amount of energy, the proper amount of energy kind of within the mechanism and the organizing groups, the enabling bodies from the United States? Are they getting energized to push this initiative for a winter game?
Well, again, you know, the USOC has changed dramatically in the last dozen years. When we were bidding for the games, the U.S. Olympic Committee board was maybe 125 people, and it was, you know, diverse people from all over the country, all walks of life. Very difficult to control. Their board is probably under 20 people today, I believe. So there's a lot more focus. They have, you know, a couple of really excellent people running the U.S. Olympic Committee. Bob Blackman, I think, is doing an excellent job as the executive director. So they're real folk, you know, and they had some issues, some revenue splitting issues with the IOC that they've just recently solved within the last 12 months, which now allows the U.S. Olympic Committee to hopefully put forth, you know, a very strong candidacy of a half a dozen cities, which I think are being considered. And then it's up to the IOC to, you know, make that vote. But again, I suspect that the next vote that the International Olympic Committee makes will be a lot safer, less political than the last few Olympic cities that we've seen.
Well, former Park City Mayor Brad Ulch, it's really nice to talk to you today. We ought to do this more often.
I'm available. You just call me.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Yeah,
my pleasure. Thank you.
And this is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Big air, big skills, big fun. Catch the Flying Ace All-Star Freestyle Show this summer at the Utah Olympic Park. Every Sunday at 1 p.m., the All-Star athletes showcase spectacular aerial talent into the Olympic aerials pool. Watch as they soar up to 60 feet in the air performing acrobatic feats. During the month of July, additional shows will be available every Saturday at 11 a.m. For show tickets and more, go to utaholympiclegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
The Glitter Tent at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitter Tent restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitter Tent serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. We were just speaking with former Park City Mayor Brad Ulch. Very interesting conversation, I thought. And
yeah, it's great to get a perspective from somebody that spends so much time traveling around the world and has that ability to compare our unique mountain resort town to other unique mountain resort towns with different models. It's really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Right. And insights that you don't always gain from just being right here in Park City and maybe looking at, you know, as I said, Aspen or Vail or, you know, wherever else.
Yeah, and it's nice to kind of see these models that have been in existence for a long period of time and that have proven track records and work. And then I like to look at Park City and say, we're kind of a, you know, we're not a completely clean slate, but we haven't put a lot of investment in areas that, you know, now create an obstacle to creating something really fascinating in the future. And I think that's the opportunity in Park City. We have that opportunity before us.
Mm-hmm. Also, on that same kind of topic, we look at ourselves as going out on a limb or being on the forefront and the progressive edge of anything to do, you know, any other towns in Utah, for
right,
example.
In Utah is the
right.
key there.
And so it is nice to look, yeah. Look to especially the European continent where they've been doing this for so many millennia, really. Very interesting. Well, okay, remember the clip from the Steve Martin movie, The Jerk, where he says, "That's all I need." His love, Bernadette Peters, is shunning him and he's crying. And he walks out the door, or he grabs an ashtray and he says, "That's all I need is this ashtray. That's it." And then he ends up needing all these other things too. But sometimes in the beginning of the summer, I think of that and I say, "That's all I need is this bicycle and this, what?
Bathing suit.
This bathing suit.
And this other bicycle."
and this pair of running shoes and this.
It just expands.
Right. But it is, it kind of brings back the simple life, because we do so much for enjoyment that is simple, especially in the summer. So we thought it would be a good idea to bring back Greg McEwen as a rebroadcast of an interview we did earlier this spring. He wrote a book called Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And he talks about that, keeping it simple and taking those things, casting those things out of our lives that make it all complicated. So we're going to rebroadcast that interview. Here's Greg McEwen.
Oh, it's so great to be with you. Thank you.
So, Greg, I have to say I received your book and I saw the title Essentialism and the tagline, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And this nice, warm, calm feeling came over me and I said, I'm going to like this concept. So, you know, what is it about me or anyone else that I run into, that you run into, that needs this book?
Well, actually, I want to put that back to you for a second. To tell me, what do you think it was for you that made you feel that way?
Well, it was probably my constant feeling of overwhelm, of trying to do more. Well, my friends always call it shoving 10 pounds of you-know-what in a 5-pound sack.
And why do you do that?
Oh, because, well, this is a quiz, isn't it? I think we do it because if we don't, we feel like we're not going to be successful in our lives.
Yeah, that's exactly the point, isn't it? And here's what I found, is that we have been sold a complete bill of goods. It's just not true. But we've been told, absolutely told and sold, and 100 times and more, that if we can fit it in, we should fit it in. If we can do more, we should do more. And we just consumed with this idea. And what I found is that far from leading to success, what it leads to is all the things you just described. It's being overworked, being underutilized. It's making a million of progress in a million directions. It's feeling stressed all the time. And always the logic that drives it is, if I do this, this leads to success. And what I'm really trying to do, what I'm trying to argue in a way on every page of this book, is for a more honest, more useful way of actually achieving success and breaking through to next level.
Greg, do you find that there are some people who are just hardwired to be multitaskers, or, as you said, have we been sold a bill of good? It seems like that sale kind of resonates or takes hold with some people, and with others, it really doesn't. I tend to be more of a focused and non-multitasker, so you were preaching to the choir with me.
Well, I don't know what it is that makes some people more willing to absorb this idea. But what I found in general is that majority of people today in the developed world, and I teach all over the place, in companies all over the world, and in levels of organizations at all levels as well. And I just think that to be alive today is to be infected with this idea at some level. And I mean, I actually think what we're in is a bubble of more. You know, we had the Silicon Valley bubble, and of course, we just went through the real estate bubble. And so we know what it is to be involved in sort of irrational exuberance.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what it's like afterwards, looking back at how foolish it all seemed. Well, I just think we're going through the same kind of bubble, but this time it's more, the bubble of more, that it's overvalued. And somehow we're losing the idea that less has value, that having space to think has value, that figuring out what's essential and what's just good has value. These things, I think, will eventually look so obvious in hindsight. Right now we're just caught up in this, as I said, exuberance of the moment.
So, Greg, there are a lot of philosophies and ancient religions that sort of incorporate this idea of less, taking time, being able to reflect, meditating, those sort of things. And I'm wondering, Is your essentialism directed at the masses and the people as those philosophies and religions were, or is your target audience these corporations that you've identified that you go and lecture to, the Amazons, the Googles, the Silicon Valleys of the world?
Well, I think, as with all true principles, they apply to all levels of human systems. So I've been fascinated over this last 15 years about, you know, what it is that holds back capable people, teams, organizations, societies, nations. From breaking through to the next level. And I think that essentialism is the antidote for a problem that we can see in all the above. So the book is deliberately written to the individual. But in the work that I do, I'm often working with teams, and often executive teams, and often whole companies. And so I think that the principles work for the one, but also for the collective.
And what does it take for an individual who reads your book and says, this makes sense? How do they implement the transition to essentialism from multitasking or being overwhelmed in life?
The first thing is the mindset. And that's what the book is primarily designed to do. So, and the reason is important. There are a lot of books out there that deal with time-saving, you know, technique here or there and how to do this more efficiently and so on. And I think there's a lot of value in that. But the problem is that if you apply those tips and tricks to a non-essentialist logic of I have to do it all, then you'll end up just doing more and more and more efficiently. And so it doesn't really solve the problem. So first you have to have a different mindset. You have to look at the sort of nonsense of non-essentialism, this kind of madness that's taken us, and admit the trade-offs. And once you become once you can adopt, at least intellectually at first, the idea that there's a different path, a different way that will help us to contribute more and better and have a more meaningful, satisfying experience. Once you adopt that, then my suggestion is to make tiny adjustments in the things we do often, either daily or weekly, tiny micro adjustments. And I can suggest a few. But first is, you know, once a week, trade off 20 minutes of watching, you know, whatever, a show, a good show, but 20 minutes of watching a TV show, and it's take that 20 minutes and go through a process of identifying for that week, here are the six essentials, here are the things that I think will really matter. Put them in priority order, and then cross off the bottom five. And what it will lead you with is the priority for that week. If I could only get one thing done this week, this is the thing. And then, of course, you can schedule it, and you can protect time around it, and you can make sure that that happens. And what you've done, of course, by doing this is you've identified the priority. And just if you will allow it just a moment, the word priority came into the English language in the 1400s, and it was singular. And what did it mean? It meant the prior thing, the first thing, the very most important thing. And it stayed in the singular form, priority, for the next 500 years. It was only in the 1900s we pluralized the term and started speaking of priorities. But what does it even mean? I mean, can you really have 10, 20, 5 even very first prior things? Of course we can't. But what's evident in that little language, configuration is that we have made ourselves believe that if you emphasize everything, that somehow that's how you'll break through. Well, you can't emphasize everything. You can't prioritize 10, 20 things. And so this logic and way of thinking is really what holds us back. I gave just one suggestion there, is 20 minutes trade-off for once a week for how we might put that into practice.
I like how our poor grammar that has kind of morphed over the years now has morphed our very behavior by the pluralization of the word priority. That's very interesting. You also take a look at the word decision and how its Latin root talks about cutting out.
It's a lovely sort of segue there, because it's the two words together that I think are powerful. And the idea of decision is that originally was intended. It comes from the root sid or sizz, as in you'd see in the words scissors or in fratricide or homicide. Yeah, literally, originally, to decide meant to cut or to kill. And that's powerful to me, because suddenly you say, okay, making a decision isn't what we say yes to, it's what we say no to. You know, strategy in business, but also in our life strategy, in our career strategy even, is defined as what we say no to. And that's the teeth of this. It's all very well saying this thing is important to me, or even this is the priority, but unless we're willing to eliminate other things in order to focus on it, then we can't call it the priority.
Uh-huh. I can't help but sit here and see this thing at the bottom of the page that says Greg holds an MBA from Stanford University. Now, when institutions or maybe our workplaces are sort of calling the shots, I can hardly picture you going to your professors at MBA school and saying, okay, so you think that there are these priorities for the semester, but I'm going to cut out five of them. I mean, there must be some way that you've got for sort of melding the two, other people's priorities or institutions' priorities for us.
Cultural
and our
priorities.
Own. Yeah.
Well, you see, I'm torn as I hear you say that because there are a few answers. But one of them, boldly or bombastically, is yes, you can. I mean, I absolutely did what you just said. Of course you can. You can choose which classes to do, of all which not to do. You can choose, even in the classes, well, this one's really vital to me. And so this is what I want to learn about. I'm going to go deep into this one over here, not so much. I'm going to do the very minimum. So there's a lot of negotiation that is possible, even in that example, which I think is a good one, where it appears to be absolutely not so. I think about as one other illustration, in a way this is who I wrote the book for, it's a real person's real story, of somebody who had come to a class on essentialism prior to the book being out, and felt empowered from this, suddenly saw a different logic, and went and negotiated with their manager at the time. They said, look, I need 5 days off work so I can focus on preparing for my wedding. And they negotiated that time, that no problem, but you've got to do this work before you go. And they did. They did it well. They got it done ahead of schedule, and they were free for this 5 days. But then the manager comes to them later and says, well, actually, I'm sorry. You are going to have to do that after all. There's an extra project. Somebody dropped the ball, and you need to do it. And in the past, and absolutely every single time in the past, she said yes to such situations. And because she'd learned this idea that there was a different way of thinking about it, she pushed back. She said, look, we made an agreement. This is how it needs to be. And she got to spend 5 days focused on her wedding entirely, got to have the joy of that and the day itself. And even put into her vows that she would essentialize her marriage over all other relationships. That's just a little inclination of how many things can be negotiated if we start that way, if we begin to believe that life is something that can be designed, not just something that has to be consumed. I'm not for a second saying this is easy. I think it takes courage. I think it's a radical idea in lots of ways. But I think that it is possible in many more instances than we allow for. So we begin with the assumption that essentials are non-negotiable, and we give up a lot of power in that assumption.
So, Greg, is there an example of somebody in our culture, kind of an iconic figure that our audience would recognize, who you believe is an example of living an essentialist life?
You know, I think there's lots of examples. We talked about a moment ago this idea of, if you want iconic.
Well, somebody that the general populace would go, oh, I get it. That's who he's talking about.
Taking it to the extreme, and I say this to inspire, not to demotivate. Gandhi was clearly an embodiment of an essentialist, certainly towards the end of his life. He called the process reducing himself to zero, and this was this constant process. He applied it in asceticism terms. He actually got rid of almost all of his belongings. He ended up with just 10 belongings at the end of his life. He was a huge advocate of simplicity in the physical items in life, but also in purpose. so that his consumer purpose was this cause of liberating, at the time, 300 million Indians. He did that. He was successful in doing it. I remember that the U.S. General Secretary, Secretary of State, excuse me, said of him that he had become the conscience for mankind. And Einstein later said of him that generations to come will scarce believe that such a one as this ever in flesh and blood walked upon the earth. That is illustrating how powerful the principle can be taken to an extreme. I find that this is a principle that the further I go with it, the deeper I go into it, the richer it becomes, the more meaningful it is, and the more it gives back to me. So I think there's a whole journey that people can go on, starting very, very, very small at one end of the continuum, but taking these small micro steps towards a very different way of living.
Greg, before we let you go, I want to ask you about how you sort of head up each separate part of your book with all of these words like essence and explore and, as we mentioned, priority and decision and eliminate. And what was kind of what about essentialism led you to organize your book in this fashion? It's very catchy. I really enjoy looking at it, and it draws me in.
Oh, I appreciate that very much. The book is divided into four parts, but really it's kind of just two, because the first part of the book is about the mindset, the essence of an essentialist. How do you think as an essentialist? How does an essentialist think? What are the contrasts? And then it shifts towards a process. Explore, eliminate, and execute. And in each of those sections, there are chapters going into various ways that we can do each of the above buckets. So the first is this principle of exploring, you know, making sure that you have space to escape, to be able to focus and discern what matters, to be able to sleep so that you can have the discernment and be able to distinguish between the trivial many and the vital few, to be able to play so that we're not just constantly doing, but we actually have space to explore and create. So this is the first, you know, pillar or principle or of essentialism. The second is to eliminate. It's to cut. It's to uncommit. It's to relentlessly remove from our lives the things that are good but not essential, and to be able to make that trade-off. And finally, there's this idea of execute. There's kind of two ways of thinking about execution. One is where we force it at the last moment. We try to make these massive, adjustments that aren't really sustainable. And on the other hand, we focus on small changes in the things we do often. And in that way, we actually are able to execute and bring about significant change. But we do it just small changes at a time and build momentum over time.
Right. Greg McKeown is the author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And Greg, I wish you the best of luck with this book, especially when you finally get through. I think it's such an important message, but it must take some cracking some shells, some pretty thick shells, you might say, to get the message through. But once you do, I'm sure you see lots of aha moments on people's faces.
I think that everybody intuitively senses the challenge that we have right now. They either are caught in the trap themselves, they're either being tricked by the trivial, pulled into all these different directions themselves, or they know somebody who is. And so there's a power of relevancy about this right now that, in a way, for me, as the author, it's lucky. But for people's lives, it's not so lucky. And I do see and feel a growing momentum of people who see the problem, see the bubble, and are making adjustments because they want to look wise in hindsight. And so I'm very excited about what I see, and I'm very optimistic about these new trends.
All right. Greg McKeown, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you ever so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that, again, Greg McKeown, the book Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Vinto is a proud sponsor of KPCW. Vinto offers wood-fired pizza and seasonal Italian cooking for lunch and dinner. Nestled at the bottom of Lower Main Street, Vinto is open year-round and now offers a summer menu with new seasonal appetizers, salads, sandwiches, pasta, pizza, and cocktails. More at vinto.com or 615-9990.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Want to thank our guest today, former Park City Mayor Brad Ulch, and also Greg McEwen, author of Essentialism. Also want to thank our underwriters.
Park City Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, and of course, Vento Pizzeria.
That's
where I think you have a very close affiliation with Vento, do you not?
I do. They employ one of my offspring.
There you go.
All right. We'll be right back. A few more words from our underwriters.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and I'm excited to announce that the Intermountain Park City Bonanza Clinic will now be a full-time Instacare. For your ongoing medical needs, you'll see our partners at the Intermountain Park City Clinic at Round Valley. For your fractures, lacerations, and urgent care needs, come by and see us at the Bonanza Instacare, 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Summer is back, and so is the Wednesday Night Concert Series from Snow Park Amphitheater. Join KPCW Wednesday nights for the live broadcast. Each week features a different act, and shows start at 6 p.m. Thanks to Grand Valley Bank. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
So the concert this Wednesday is going to be Bonanza Town. They go by BZT. They play rock, they play blues, they play soul, they play a little hip-hop. And that should be a lot of fun. They're known for getting people out on the dance floor, according to Mountain Town Music, that brings a lot of music to town during the summer and year-round. And, of course, that's put on by Grand Valley Bank.
That's right. And, of course, since we missed due to the snowstorm, that seems kind of like a long time ago.
But Afro Omega. It was last week.
Just last week. So that one was canceled. So I guess it's
It wasn't canceled. It was postponed until the end of the season. That'll be September 3rd, I believe, was the date that they rescheduled that one for.
I think you're right. So everyone come on out this evening. Also, don't forget the Back Alley Bash taking place this Friday. It's a summer celebration hosted by Cole Sport and KPCW. A wonderful evening out on the Town Lift Plaza. And tune in tomorrow to Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. We'll be talking about some medical technology.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Time now. In 1 minute for news. We have a minute to kill. I love when that happens. Well, next week we'll be talking with Todd Hageman. He is the technical director, I believe is his title, of the Tour of Utah. We'll hear about what's going on with the tour, where all, I mean, it's been published for several months now, but one of the great things is Camas Town is hosting Stage 5. I can't remember if it's the start or the finish.
Pretty sure it's the finish.
Okay. And they are making a big celebration out of that. They're going maybe like they've never gone before in Camas to celebrate that stage. And so that'll be a lot of fun. That's all taking place the first week of August. But we'll speak with Director Todd Hageman next week. And we'll also talk to someone who's written a book about a bike ride across America.